Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2013. Lecture 23, delivered on April 16, 2013. The title of this lecture is The Underwriting Process.
Today, the underwriting process for a public offering. Before I do that, though, I'm going to give you an assignment that you need to get done by this weekend, because on Thursday we will be preparing for the exam two review on Thursday. On Tuesday, 1 week from today, we test exam two. On the way to that, go to my website where the podcasts are, isu-prof.com. You'll have an assignment. I'll also put these links in the RegiNet for you as well, but they're right here in the sidebar. I already assigned you to read part one of The Federal Reserve Under Fire. You'll read part one and part two. And I also want you to read The Economics of Wreckage, parts one, two, three, and four. The Economics of Wreckage was the series I wrote warning that there was going to be an economic and financial crisis in 2008. Starting in 2007. Now, part one I revised when we got closer to the danger zone, showing what was happening to stocks. Although the stock market was going up, you can't just look at the nominal price rise. You have to adjust for inflation. It turned out that adjusting for inflation, people had been losing money in the stock market since about 2002. That and the fact that wages had stagnated. And finally, that business investment as a percent of GDP had buckled in 2007 was more than enough, along with the yield curve inverting, to indicate that there was going to be a recession. In parts 1, 2, 3, and 4 of the Economics of Wreckage, you learn how to do this, the theory and the practice of looking at an economy to know what financial markets are going to do. As I've told you before, we're coming close again. The same kinds of indicators are beginning to show up that something bad could happen. Whether it will or not, I don't know. It's a little too early to tell. But you're going to read in these series what happened and the why. You're going to find out the terms like bubbles. There was a bubble in the housing market. That's the stupidest ass stuff on earth. And I'm not opinionated. It's stupid. Because when you say, oh, it was a bubble, well, what does that mean? I blow bubbles when I fart in the bathtub. Never mind. I'm just thinking about some music I've written that's pretty cool that way. But anyway, you're going to learn about this and how financial markets and how economic theory, what you should have learned in your economics courses that you probably didn't or forgot or ignored, thank God. And you'll see it all here. And then there will be a couple of other articles. But I will cover these at the beginning of Thursday, even if you haven't gotten them read. I'll go through some basics before I do my review for the exam. Some basic questions from this series will be on exam two and on the final. So know that the links are here in this, and I'll also put the links on the RegiNet site, too, if you don't want to go here because it's creepy and dark and all of that. Okay? Anyway. But just to give you an idea real quick here, for example, part one of the Economics of Wreckage. I had revised it. I wrote it originally, published in March of 2007, and then I revised it somewhat later to warn about what was coming and show that even though the stock market seemed to be rising, if you adjusted for inflation, you were having an absolute disaster happen in securities. The old rule is that if you buy and hold a well-diversified portfolio over a long period of time, you'll do well. You'll make a nice return as long as you don't panic and get out and jump back in and waste your money on transactions costs. Just buy and hold. Keep your portfolio balanced against the market portfolio. Choose your beta for your risk level. You'll be fine. Well, unbelievably, look what was happening. Over a long period, a period of 7 years, people were losing money in real terms. In one case, if you were investing in a portfolio, a diversified portfolio of the NASDAQ, which is a little bit risky, you would have put $1,000 in about 2001, in January of 2001. You would have come back out in 2008, I should say, with $700 and some odd in real purchasing power. Safer portfolio, like the S&P 500, you would have lost less, but because it's safer, but you would have still lost. Even the Dow, massive companies, you would have lost real purchasing power. And I explained what was going on, why that would have been happening. Going on to part two, just to cover it so that you know what you're facing when you read this. This is the economics of record showing the GDP, but showing how household debt had been rising over a period of time as people were using borrowed money to keep their living standards up because their wage money had stagnated. So we were living in an illusion in that time period that we could borrow to keep from feeling the effects of a declining, degrading economic condition that was happening in the first decade of the 21st century. Average wages over a very long period of time have seemed to be going up because of inflation, but in real purchasing power, you folks are not making any more than your grandparents did. Really, you are not making any more in terms of purchasing power. Yeah, man, but I got an iPad. Yeah, that's nice. My grandpa was pretty impressed with his little transistor radio, too. The reality of it is that there has been this stagnation of wages. One of the ways the economy kept growing was by not actually growing the wages, which meant that people had to work harder and longer in order to keep together, to make ends meet, which allowed for corporate profits to go up. The same, though, was happening in the 21st century, the first decade, with stocks. Equity was not actually making more over that period of time in real terms, which meant that the equity component of security, of capital investment, had to work harder to achieve no gain at all, in fact, to lose ground. And then you'll see some hourly wage figures, accelerations of growth and all that, that are complicated. And don't sweat it. Look at them a couple of times, and it begins to soak in. Oh, I see, I guess, kind of what he's doing there. Going to part three, just I'm trying to give you a little warning about what you're seeing, sort of an overview. This is where you have to survive it. It's you have to read it a couple of times because you're thinking, what the F is he doing here with these graphs? Eventually, you begin to get the idea of what happens with monetary policy, that in the short run, it creates a real effect. But in the long run, that effect evaporates into inflation, which is what will eventually happen with us. You can pour money in real for a while, and people work harder, corporate profits go up. But after a period of time, everyone realizes, well, it's not real purchasing power, and then the economy settles back down to where it was before the expense. Then you see the growth rate of the money supply. I had shown you this before, and I'm showing it to you in these articles, that the Federal Reserve actually contributed massively to the crisis in 2008 by choking off liquidity that was used by people and businesses, while the growth rate of these euro-dollar liquidities and all this fancy money was going through the roof, which led to the credit derivative crisis, which you see I mention in here. And then in part four, this finishes it up, explaining, sort of tying it all together, and showing this little equation that shows how our percent of GDP is combined. It actually has four different components, and how we were using the cheap Chinese goods, which we were allowing the Chinese to peg their currency at a ludicrously low rate against the dollar. And so we bought toasters and stuff like that from China. In exchange, we sent China, their central bank, American dollars, which China then lent to us to keep us, our heads above water. We borrowed as a government because our taxes were cut so low. We borrowed as people because we weren't making more, so we borrowed. Businesses were trying to do the same thing. They were the ones who buckled first because of the competition from government and from people borrowing. Business investment collapsed in 2007. It was already bad through the first 7 years of the 21st century. It got terrible in 7, and it broke over, and it started declining, which was right there. You're going to have a major recession. And I explain all that in here, and by the end of it, you begin to get the idea, oh, I think I understand what's going on. You see that essentially, and I'll show you here, the percent as a GDP of private investment. You'll see that, for example, 1998, 17.25% of the GDP was private investment. 1999, 17.54. 2000, 17.68. See this slow growth of it? That's not very good. And then in 2001, you had the first difficulty. Something was going wrong with private investment. Look at it. It's starting to collapse. While the government component was continuing to rise, the government component, and the consumer component was continuing to rise as a percent of GDP, the private investment component was beginning to slide. But then it started to recover through the first 2006, and there it was. Look, 2007, it buckled hard down. That meant no investment was falling, new jobs, old jobs were going away. Private investment began to come apart. That was the flag that 2008 was going to be a very bad year, because once private investment begins to slide, it continues to slide. Meanwhile, interestingly enough, government was staying pretty much flat through that period. We were already, the government was spending extraordinary amounts of money on two theater wars, the government was, and it came up more and more because we were ramping up Afghanistan more and more, and we were still trying to do something about Iraq. But notice the consumer investment began to sort of piddle out. It didn't grow anymore. Became stable as a percent of GDP. Government investment was going up because of the wars, but private investment, you got government going up, consumer staying the same, all the money being provided, most of that money being provided by taxes. What couldn't be provided by taxes was being provided by the net flow of money we were sending to the People's Bank of China, to Canada, to the Arab states, for all their products we were importing. They were getting that money back to us to allow us to live beyond our means. Government kept absorbing more of it as a percent of GDP. Now remember, this isn't the Obama administration. This was the administration before that. And as a result, something had to give. It was private investment. It buckled. It fell. Because essentially, you had the government just absorbing money that it needed, that it couldn't pay for through taxes. You had consumers trying to hold their own in a market where their wages weren't rising, but prices were rising around them. And so something had to give, and sure enough, what gave was the private sector of capital investment. No jobs were forming. And then without any money being poured in by the Fed to keep the base economy liquid, you had a liquidity crisis. We came very close to the to one day your ATMs would not have worked anymore. Your paychecks, you wouldn't have been able to get the money out. It came that close. And so this teaches you how to look for it, how to see the signs of it, how to understand what happened and why it happened. And this is right, and how do I know it's right? Because I called it right. And so there you go. Thank God you have me for your professor. And then budget, of course, as you talk about budgets, we were, through the 1990s, we were paying off the budget deficits. We were coming closer and closer to a surplus. By the end of the 1990s, we had actually gotten into large budget surpluses. We had the ability to start paying off old debt that we'd had since World War II. We could fund Social Security for centuries. We were talking about all this money that we could then spend on research to colonize the planets, to move to alternate energy resources. All of that was available to us. And then, because there was this claim that we had a recession happening in 2001, which there wasn't, you'll see that in this series too, there was no recession, we had the longest, largest tax cuts in history. Well, spank me, Jesus, look what happened. You put together a massive tax cut with two theater wars, and look, all those budget surpluses went away. We could have put away enough money so that even a bad recession, we could have paid ourselves out of it. We could have bought ourselves out of it. But by the time we get to the 2003, 2004, we were in such financial red ink again as a country. There was not a prayer that we could buy our way out of it. So this last bad one we had, we spent close to $1 trillion to climb out of it. We borrowed it. We borrowed it. And the Fed printed money for it, just printed the money. So this gives you an idea of what you're facing when you read these. The graphs are informative. Don't sweat them. If it does, saying, no, that doesn't even make sense, don't sweat that. It's a matter of just understanding the logic. One last thing here. Let me point out something interesting. Just a comparison, and this is where we get into the business aspect of it. If you were to look at the years from 1993 to 2000 versus the years from 2001 to 2007, we have government spending at 1.39% growth rate in the 1990s, versus 1.72%, about 50% higher during the first 7 years of the 21st century. Private investment in the 1990s was 6.12% growth rate per year. It was less than, it was about half of that in 2001 to 2007. That right there is a giant warning sign that the economy can't just keep producing jobs, producing opportunities for people like you, when you have half of the growth rate of private investment. In other words, new factories, new buildings, new offices, new capital needs, new human capital demand, half of what it was in the 1990s. And then consumption. In the 1990s, we were buying like bandits. We were keeping the economy going really strong. It collapsed in the 2000s. That, again, no, the buying falls, the growth rate of buying falls, which means the consumers are not buying, which means that companies are not hiring to produce, to sell. All of that is the inheritance you have gotten. And if that doesn't piss you off, then nothing's going to piss you off except Honey Boo Boo, which should piss you off anyway. But you understand that you are living in the dark times. The 1990s were the heyday. And what you've had, what we've had since then, what you are walking into is a dark corridor compared to that. So I want you to read this, because you're not going to find it out anyplace else. You're walking into a business world that is a hell of a lot different from one that was just 10, 15 years ago. It's more competitive because there aren't as many jobs. Companies are a lot more scrutinizing. They claim that they want only the 4-point GPAs. We don't want any of that other stuff. It's because there's not enough jobs out there. So they're hiring these bright, bright people and leaving behind everyone who probably would be better long-term producers for their companies. And you're also going to find that government spending is going to continue to increase as a percentage of the economy, for no other reason that in the 1990s, we didn't have a war economy. In your lifetimes, we're going to be a permanent war. It's called the Global War on Terror, and all we're going to do is pick one battlefield after another. Iraq, Iran, North Africa, Central Asia, South Asia. Then we'll put some hard firepower into East Asia, where we'll have to deal with North Korea. Your lives will be a war economy. War economies are great for the first couple of years, and then they are debilitating. So know all of this, and that's why I'm having you read this, because this gives you the chance to see what I mean by the economics of wreckage and what you're going to be doing in that economy. Now let me go get on to the first. And, of course, I wanted you to feel just all really good all over about that, make you really want to go home and, you know, go emo and cut yourselves and all that, which is okay, you know. The deal is this, you see, because in the business world that you're going to go into, it's going to be a really rough world for you to get a job and to keep a job. And business is essentially, the tougher it is for business, the meaner it'll get for the people who work for businesses. You're going to have a hard time finding jobs and keeping jobs. You'll probably have to shift around a lot during your lives just to keep your income going up, or at least to keep it stable. Prospects from a financial analyst that I know, whom I know, he and I are sort of in agreement. I'm a little more liberal than he is on the amount of money. But it's in the ballpark for you to have a retirement where you are comfortable, where you have all the things that you need. You have noms every day. You have your health care. You have maybe a nice place that won't be taken away from you. The number that we would, I'll give you his number. The number he would say for how much you have in assets, net worth, to live from the age of about 70 to 100 and or 110, which most of you will. This is the amount of money he says you will need in net worth. I'm a little more. I say 50. But either way, you think about that kind of money. How in the hell could you get from where you are now? Check the money in your pocket. Look under the seat of your car. How much money do you have in net worth now? And how you're going to make it to a number, even in the same world with this number, by the time you are 70 years old? That's finance. That's essentially, it's not just an opinion. It's an inevitability, where we are headed, what you would need. Now, I've given you the happy story. The bluebird of happiness is probably just floating around your head right now. So let's talk about finishing this up with stocks. The underwriting process. You want to have a company that raises capital through common stock. Now, remember what I told you, that selling common stock might not be the best signal a company can give. Because if a company is selling common stock, first of all, it's saying, we are willing to raise money that is very expensive. Remember that the component cost of new issue equity is the highest cost a firm can bear. So if a company is so hard up that it has to raise money through an issue of common stock, it's saying we're out of other places to go, so essentially it would be like you going to payday loans. Dude, why don't you just, you know, borrow some money from a bank where you can get a, well, you can't do that, can you? That's why you're going to the ripoff places. So that's the first suspicious sign that there's something wrong with a company that's issuing common stock. The second thing, as I told you in the last lecture, and I want you to remember these because I will ask you an essay question about it. You might want, oh, damn, I better write this down. Was the point that, look, if a company is selling common stock, it is more or less telling the markets, we think that you are overvaluing the stock. We think you are overvaluing the stock. So we're going to catch you suckers while the stock price is too high. And so that tells the markets, oh, they think, because if you thought the stock price was too low, if you're a company, and you wouldn't sell your stock if the price in the market was too low. So you're thinking that the stock price probably is a little too high, so you're going to sell stock while the price is high. Now, what that will do, of course, as the supply of stock of your stock outstanding increases, supply goes up, price goes down. That issue is going, that new issue is going to cause, other things being equal, a decline in the stock price. Sooner or later, maybe not right away, but sooner or later. Now, the first thing that I want to get to here, before I go any further, is what is called efficient market hypothesis. Efficient market hypothesis. Now, the reason it's called hypothesis is not because it's a speculation. There are some who say, oh, this isn't true at all. So we give them the recognition, okay, you don't think this is true. You're an asshole, but we'll let you go. It is true. The logic is just there. And I've gone through this before, but I want to make sure you know this for the exam. The first possible way that markets are efficient is in what is called weak form. Weak form efficiency says that all stock prices already have all public information in them. So in other words, if there's information that is typically public, that comes out as public information in the news media or through the regular filings of the company, then that information is instantaneously going to be in the stock price. In other words, you get nothing out of looking at stock information, company information, that everyone else can see. Because by the time you could react to it, the markets have already taken care of that information and put it in the stock price. 10 seconds ago, you found out that this company had reported less than its earnings that were below expectations. It's too late to do anything about that. The stock price will already have been down. Public information is impounded so rapidly that you can't get anything out of it. That's why the people who read the newspapers, oh, I'm going to read the newspaper and then I'll be a real good investor. You're not going to. You're up against Goldman Sachs that can reach into the future. They can buy from what's going to happen in a couple of seconds. So you're not going to get anything out of that. So let's go to the second form, semi-strong. Semi-strong says that the current price of stocks has all the public information and includes some not public information. In other words, it would also include analytical information that you would have to tease out from thinking about a security. It would include information that was in the company's internal filings and records and all of that. Not necessarily insider information, but information that just wouldn't be known to Joe Hohandle, even if he was relatively sophisticated. The stock price, in other words, you can't just react to the news that's streaming and get something and beat the market. You can't react to the news that's streaming and analyze it and beat the market because the market will already have done it. That's what financial engineers do. We're the quant jockeys who have the computers that can think faster than anyone on earth, bar none. They can analyze that data 5 ways to Sunday and get that into the stock price. Oh, here's something that's a positive sign, buy. You can't do that because they'll get it done in a couple of microseconds. They can do it that fast. And finally, the strong form of efficiency says that all public and all private information is already in the stock price. So in other words, even insider information is already there. You couldn't be inside the company and beat the company. You couldn't be someone with a wire device in the board meeting and get to the stock price in time. Now, where's the reality of it? Which form does the market take? Like I said, there are people out there who say, oh, there's no efficient markets. That's just not true. And they can give you a couple of examples, which I should point out here. But if you are not an idiot, and if you aren't someone who pretends that markets aren't efficient, if you believe in the efficiency of markets, if you have seen the efficiency and you understand it, and where the data seems, the studies seem to fall, is on the semi-strong form. The markets are semi-strong efficient. That seems to be, now, as I said, there are some studies that can say, here is an example of a security that is consistently, or a group of securities, or an investor who consistently beats the market. In other words, the expected returns are above beta, consistently. Now, there are a couple of examples of this. There's one called the January effect. There are certain stocks that always seem to beat their risk in terms of the return every January. Well, how that happens, that one's one of those, okay, this is the exception that tests the rule. How could that possibly, if the market is efficient, you would have everyone buying into these stocks in December, and so they would already have gone up before the January. And then, of course, people would see that there was a buying in December, so they'd beat it in November. So there'd be this, eventually, there would be this washout effect. But it seems to keep happening. I can't tell you that one, except that that one is along the lines of when the time you were driving in the country years and years ago, and an alien mothership flew by, and then it stopped in a field and sucked a cow up. Okay? Now, what are you going to do about that? Are you going to change your life? Are you going to write books about it? Tell everyone? Or are you just going to go on with your life? Yeah, you go on with your life. Okay? So, I don't know how I get these examples, but you see, it's one of those things where, yeah, it's a weird thing, but everything else we look at, that seems to not hold. There's another one called the Warren Buffett effect. Anything that Warren Buffett says is good, that Warren Buffett invests in, seems to have an expected return above its risk level. That would seem to blow away even the weak form of efficiency, because we know what he's going to get. The explanation for that one is actually kind of easy. It's actually that Warren Buffett creates a market by his entry into it. He becomes a market factor. No one else on earth probably could do that, but he actually becomes part of the market force itself. His existence becomes part of the public, his investment in it becomes part of the public information, and so it kind of bumps it up where it otherwise wouldn't be. So we don't adjust for the Warren Buffett effect, so it seems like it's anomalous. But if we were to put it in there, if there's this Buffett effect, then the semi-strong form comes back into play. But there are other exceptions too, but this is the one that seems to be out there. I want you to make sure you know these, because I will ask about this as an essay question on exam 2. I will ask about this. And I will also give you links for a written explanation as well to go along with this. The book also covers it to a certain extent. Okay, now, let me get on to something else here. The stock process, selling stock. Remember, as I said, it seems that when a company sells stock, that is not the greatest sign in the world. It's raising money through its most expensive component cost of capital, with the vehicle of its most expensive component cost of capital. It's telling the markets that it is selling stock because it thinks the markets are pricing the stock too high, so it's going to try to catch that higher than intrinsic value price. And also, by selling the stock, it's going to cause prices of the stock outstanding to go down because the supply has increased. Okay, now, the underwriting process, and I've gone through some basics of this before, and I'll summarize it here. Essentially, when you sell common stock, it's funny, I don't think the book even mentions this one, and this is the one that I was sort of a specialist in. Self-underwriting. You sell the stock, the company sells the stock itself, or sells it through some consultants and works with consultants. in private placements. That's a self-underwriting. That's what I used to be hired to do. I would create the documents to make it a legal sale, offer and sale, and then the company would go out, and I might try to help as well, and we would sell the stock to sophisticated investors to raise money. If it was a Reg D 504, you'll remember from my last lecture, in a Reg D 504, we could sell up to $1 million worth of stock to anyone, as long as we were allowed to do it in that state, in the states where offers and sales were permitted under the exemption of Reg D 504. But the self-underwriting is a meat grinder. I mean, you know, trying to sell stock to people is really tough business. And oftentimes, what we would, well, not oftentimes, but it got down to the point where suppose that we were doing something like a 505 or a 506. Remember, those are, you can raise money through selling stock to sophisticated investors. Ultimately, what we would usually end up doing is some version of sophisticated investors who would, if they even were interested in this company and its possible prospects, they would want a major stake in the company, a big piece of the action. Venture capitalists are not going to say, okay, I'll buy 10% of the equity in this company. They'll say, no, we're going to buy 90, 95% of the equity. If you want the money that badly, you, the owners, who are the majority control right now, are going to give up pretty much everything you've got to get this money. You'll have some left over, and you'll be able to get salaries as the executive officers under our watch and under the watch of our accountants and our lawyers. But we want pretty much the whole shebang. That's one of the things where it was kind of difficult because, you know, you have this company, these guys have been working, building this little idea, maybe spent a lot of money on patents and trademarks, building prototypes, and they needed more money to get going, to actually keep going or to get the product to market. And only then, the people I worked with and I were the ones who said, okay, we can get you the money to get the product to market, but you're going to give up 95% of this company. You'll get to keep 5%. One case, you'll get to keep 2%. That was one of the really hardest conversations that you could have because there are these people, 3 years this one group had been working in research and development, spending their own money out of their own pockets, paying for this really expensive stuff, only to have these people like me and my co-consultants from Coral Gables swagger in and say, yeah, we can do it, but our money people are going to want 95% of your company. And God, you should have, I was called every name that began with mother you could think of. But there you are. That's why I hate venture capitalists. I hate them with a passion. And vulture capitalists are even worse. And both of these are, you hear stories of venture and vulture capitalists, and you might associate them with names like Mitt Romney or Donald Trump, or something like that. Well, they go down to people you think might be good guys, like Al Gore, or Soros, or Buffett. They are just the same breed of predators who wait for companies to get so weak, the people to get so desperate, that they just give up. And they say, all right, fine, whatever. And then I can finish a self-underwriting on a Reg A, Reg D 506, something like that, and we can go on from there. Or the company can die. And either way, it's going to be a grim thing. In one case, a company, these guys had the chance to get enough money to get their product to market. But they were going to have to give up most of the ownership of the company. They were going to have a chief executive officer who was put there from the venture capital group. They were going to have essentially their lives changed. They were no longer going to be the freewheeling venture startup, all that kind of stuff, they were going to be someone's bitch. And they decided, we're not going to do it. They said, we're going to find our own way. It was about 6 months later, and it was in an October late afternoon when we met at a table. It was getting dark outside. And it was just barely lit in the dining room of the guy's house. And his wife had left him, and the other guy there, I don't know what had happened to his girlfriend. And then their son was part of the operation. It was getting dark, and I said, well, we just sat there. It was dead silent. And finally, I said, it's time to close this company down. You know that, don't you? No one said anything, and it was so dark I couldn't tell who was doing it, but someone was sobbing. One of the guys was sobbing. And that was the end. It got dark, and after a while, finally, we turned on some lights and had some whiskey. And that was, you know, basically the end. You either choose to have the underwriting, self-underwriting done through the venture, or you die. They chose the second. They stood on their feet, and they fell from their feet. Second way is what is called a best efforts. Now, I did some of these in the old days. And this is what's called, there's an old term, we call these Westerns, Western syndicates. What a best efforts is, I want to raise, let's say, $1 million by selling 100,000 shares at $10 a share. What I'll do is I will call up a group of real low-level penny stock house types of brokers. And I'll say, okay, I need to try to get this underwriting done. And, you know, they'll, well, you think we're going to give you the money for it? No, no. I just want you to commit to sell some of this stock. You don't have to sell it. There's no, you're not committing that you will, but you're going to try to. Best efforts. So I would form maybe, I find maybe five brokerage, five penny stock houses working with me, and I'd say, all right, now I got to get 100,000 shares sold, so we're going to do 20,000 with each of you, and then you're going to keep a hellacious commission so that by the end of the day, you make a penny off this, and the company gets enough money, say $875,000 after the brokerage fees, after the commissions, after the legal paperwork and phony fees, you'll get some money. And so on a best efforts basis, I form a syndicate. If you get it, if you sell, you sell. If you don't, you don't. It's best efforts, okay? Oftentimes in a best efforts, in order to sweeten the pot, I'd have to give these brokerage houses, quote unquote, inventory of stock. I have to give them some extra stock of this company to give them an incentive to make a market in it afterwards, or I would have to have some honeypot in my inventory that I would share with them. In other words, a previous offering, I had some stock that I would share with them in order to sweeten the deal for them to sell this new start stock. That's the best efforts. And then there's the firm underwriting. This is where the underwriting syndicate, and I'll explain that term in a minute more deeply, the underwriting syndicate buys the stock from the company and then sells the stock itself. The company, in other words, is guaranteed that the offering will finish successfully. These are big, important issues of stock where you are dealing with the best brokerage houses, underwriting of houses in the world. Where they essentially, you'll get a lead underwriter. The lead underwriter, then underneath him, it forms a syndicate of other big investment firms. These are other big stock houses that become part of the group that buys the stock. And it works a couple of different ways. Just to give you an example, the lead underwriter could buy the entire issue from the company that's issuing the stock. And then the underwriter has already worked out the details so that the syndicate members under the lead would each buy a certain portion of those from the lead and then sell them for its account. You follow how it works? It's just basically guarantee Facebook will buy all of that stock, the lead will, or the lead with the syndicates, one way or the other. The company gets its money minus the massive brokerage underwriting fees, and then the leads go out and sell the stock for their own accounts as dealers. The dark side of this is the following. you would probably no time in your life ever see a primary offering, buy stock in a primary. In other words, there is not a time when you would buy a fancy company stock from the company as part of the new issue. You just wouldn't do it. Because the lead and the syndicate have and its syndicate have absorbed the issue. And then they sell the issue for their accounts. It's even more complex because the lead and the syndicate, the first thing they're going to do is to make sure that they have unloaded this stock before the stock even goes out the door from the firm. They're going to have called their best customers and made sure that they have already sold the stock to their best clients. Wealthy people, families, trusts, companies, investment groups. They have already sold it, pre-sold it. So it's not like they're on the hook. They make sure that they've got that issue already sold, pre-sold to the people that they want to sell it to. And then comes the next part of it, the fun part. Because you see, once I'm a broker at a brokerage house. The brokerage house bought the new issue in the primary market from the company. And then I made sure that for my clients, my rich clients, each of them had already been guaranteed a part of that offering. And you're a very wealthy person. I'm going to make sure that you've already bought at nearly the issue price, $40 a share. We're going to make sure that you get it. At $40 a share. You're my client, I'm the broker, I work for one of the underwriters in the syndicate. Okay, so you got it in your account at $40 a share. Okay, then once that's done, the offering is suddenly just out there, everyone hears about it. My next job is to call you and you and you because you're my losers, you're my suckers. You hear Facebook is actually gone public, I have a chance to get some of the stock. I really do. I could probably get you in on the stock. It's going to go up, but I can get you in if you're interested in this hot new issue. And I got a couple of other people here that are going to want it too. Okay? So I create the hype, and that pushes the stock price up like that. And then I call you. Time to sell. And you say, okay, because I can sell it now at $55 a share. And I sell it to you and you. I'm getting Facebook stock at $50, $55 a share. Wow, you are a great broker. Yes, I am. I've made you your money. You're my client. You're my money client. You people are my suckers who take the ball after I've thrown it, the Hail Mary, to you. Don't buy public offerings right out of the box because you will be on the remember that multi-story outhouse I told you about? You will be on floor one of the skyscraper shit house. Okay? Now, let's take you down the line here. Tombstones. The process will be like this. There's going to be this massive document, a red herring. Okay, this is the prospectus, which is part of the larger filing that describes the offering to the SEC. The prospectus is issued to the people who are considering buying it. Before the offering is qualified, and remember, a stock, no public offering is ever approved by the SEC. It is qualified or it is found deficient. I will try to trip you up in a multiple choice question on exam two by using the word approved in talking about a regulatory filing. The government does not approve of you. It's like my Jewish mother. She never approved of me. I didn't get to be a doctor, okay? But she qualified me. You can come in and eat. Don't put your feet on the table. Okay. So, there will be a quiet period after qualification. During that period, the prospectus can be shown around, but it has red lettering on it. In other words, nothing can be bought, nothing can be sold during this period, but you have this document that describes the offering floating around. Once the quiet period is over, red goes off, and you are in the game, and the prospectus is moving around. The prospectus, remember, is only a part of the full filing with the SEC, but the prospectus is what is shown to everyone. Now, what will happen in old school terms is that you're going to see in newspapers, financial newspapers, and I don't know, honestly, the rules on the internet for this, because it's still old school. You'll find these in the Wall Street Journal and financial publications all the time. These are called tombstones. All they do is talk about the name of the company, the price per share, and the underwriting syndicate, the major players in the underwriting syndicate. Now, understand that what you see on the tombstone, I've seen these syndicates that are just hundreds deep. But all you see listed usually are the top dogs in the syndicate. But I've seen syndicates go all the way down, stock being allocated way down in this. And that's one of the things that's big in a brokerage business, is that time when you've finally gotten enough legitimacy that you get a chance to play a little part in an underwriting syndicate, a real underwriting syndicate. Never got there myself. They shut my house down before. But, you know, there you go. But anyway, one of the things you'll see is that this tombstone right at the top will say, this is neither an offer to sell nor a solicitation for an offer to purchase the securities described below. Only the prospectus available through blah, 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 the underwriting syndicate, the lead underwriter, may be used for such purposes. So in other words, this is not a selling document. It's not an advertisement. It's simply a notice. Hey, this company is about to sell this much of some kind of stock or stock and warrants or something like that at certain price. Preliminarily, it's set. The price might change as the date approaches. And these are the underwriters in the syndicate. So it's like an announcement. But it is not the selling document. The only thing that is a selling document is the prospectus. You have to get a prospectus to a buyer prospective buyer can buy. You just have to make sure that happens. It all goes through a real ritualized process. And then the stock is sold and all of that kind of stuff, and the company goes on. It's got equity money, expensive. Now, there are variations on this, and one that I want to bring up, and I can't remember whether I did or not. You think about a stock offering, just all of a sudden a pile of stock is sold. There is another kind that is very common with companies that are very large. It's called a shelf offering. Now, a shelf offering is done on the Form S-1, as I had mentioned before, but it essentially works like this. We are going to register with the SEC this insanely large amount of stock. But then we're not going to sell it all at once. We're going to have all of this that's already taken care of with the filings and all of that. And we'll pull some off the shelf and sell it as we need to. So in other words, the underwriting syndicate would, if it were a shelf registration for a billion shares, the underwriting syndicate might arrange for, okay, you're going to pull $50 million off the shelf this year, maybe $120 million off the shelf next year, and when the price gets good again, we'll pull some more off the shelf. So in other words, the shelf registration gives the company the ability to create an externally generated equity cash flow out. You got the idea. I mean, I thought it was kind of a cool idea, but I thought it was kind of rare back in my time. Turns out, as I read more about companies these days, a lot of these times when you see this new stock coming out, well, there's no filing. And I thought, wait, what's going on here? And then I go back, oh, this was a shelf registration 3 years ago. And the company is simply just pulling more off the shelf and selling it through the underwriting syndicate out in the market. You see, there are two parts to the logic here. One is that you can create, as I said, externally generated cash flow. In other words, it's not just a one-trick pony. It keeps happening. But there's another thing that happens that's about it, too. You see, by not selling all of that stock at once, it's not creating a major impact downward on the price. The price vector will be downward, but you don't have that a billion shares all at once. That's going to crater that stock. But if the company doles it out 50, 100, 70 at a time, you'll just get this suppressant, and then the stock will rise with good information, suppress it with another issue off the shelf. And so that keeps the company's stock from dropping too hard from a single punch into the market. So there are a lot of reasons for these shelf registrations to have become as popular as they are. And apparently, they're a little more popular than I had thought they were. Okay, now, a couple of things I'll just mention. Preferred stock. Companies had, there was a long, long time ago, preferred stock was kind of popular for companies to sell. And for investors, preferred stock is actually kind of a desirable thing if they want a safe fixed income investment, because a preferred share of stock pays a known dividend every year forever. It went out of vogue because forever is a long marriage. Remember, equity is debt, as I have said early in the course, debt is a one-night stand. Now, you can like that one-night stand and go back for more debt, or you can say, the hell with that, I'm changing the locks. That was bad. Especially when I woke up next to Lassie. Okay, now, but equity is a marriage. Marriage means that you are with that dog forever, or horse, or cow, or whatever else comes out in the middle of the night. So it's not that, and with preferred stock, you're going to have to pay a dividend. I mean, with common stock, you don't have to pay a dividend. They'll bitch at you, your shareholders will. But with preferred stock, oh, you got to pay it forever. So preferred stock kind of went out of vogue. But now what I'm seeing is a kind of preferred stock where there is a, like, it's got like a call on it. The company can call that preferred stock in down the road. 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Two ways that it can call it in. One is the company has a preemptive right to buy this preferred stock back after a certain number of years. A classic call. But then there's a version where after a certain number of years, the company has the right to turn it into common stock, which would essentially be like a convertible. So preferred stock already is sort of like debt, because debt pays a fixed coupon, preferred stock pays. These new variations on preferred make it even more like a debt instrument, because you can have callable preferred and you can have convertible preferred, which, of course, is kind of adverse to the investors, and it takes away one of the qualities of preferred stock, that safety. But it seems to be kind of popular, and I'm seeing it out there. Now, I'm going to go to something else. It's called a warrant. These are very popular. The most common way you would see these is with companies that give what they call stock options to their executives. They're not really options usually. They're not always options. They can be warrants. Warrant gives the owner the right to purchase a share of stock at a specific price, regardless of what the price of the stock is. In other words, I could have a warrant that gave me the right to purchase the stock at $2.50, no matter what the price of the stock was. So if I had this warrant and the price went up to $50, I got a warrant that says I can buy a share of stock from the company itself at this ludicrously low price. You see how a warrant works? Now, I tell you where I ran into warrants was in some of these companies. In some of these companies, selling the stock of these companies was just like, how am I ever going to sell this? The company's got some prospects, yeah, but how could I sweeten the pot? So what I did was I did these things called unit offerings. And a unit offering, I'll give you one that, this is actually how I did it. I was selling not shares of stock. I was selling units. One unit comprised, and I would sell, let's say, I would sell the unit at $6, comprised a share of stock, one share of common, one, and this is one I actually did, one warrant striking at $7.50, and another warrant that struck at $9. They're pot sweeteners. Now, you understand if the stock is selling at about, let's say, $5, $6, $7, these warrants are useless. But if the investor buys the share of stock, he gets to have these warrants too. So that essentially, if the stock does go up in price, let's say the price goes to $8, the investor has the right to buy one of those $8 shares of stock for $7.50. And if the stock continues to grow over time, say to $10, this investor who bought one of these units has that share of stock, has a share of stock there, and can buy a $10 share of stock for $9. So the idea of these warrants goes beyond just executive compensation. They can be part of a deal where you are offering more than just a share of common stock. And if you look at offerings, surprisingly, you'll see unit in the tombstone. It won't say share. It might say unit. Or it might say a share and a warrant, which means it's a unit offering, not a stock offering. And these are actually kind of popular. There's two kinds of warrants. There are those that are detachable and those that are non-detachable. A non-detachable warrant, you have to have the stock to be able to exercise the warrant. You can't have sold your stock. The warrant carries with the stock. This is a non-detachable. You can't have the warrant naked. But a detachable warrant is more valuable because essentially, say I bought this unit offering at $6. The price of the stock has gotten to $6.75. I could actually, with the detachable warrants, literally peel them off, and I could sell each of them separately on its own. For an investor who said, oh, well, I think the stock's going to go up in price. Oh, here's someone who's offering a warrant at $7.50. He's offering it for $1. So with the detachable warrant, you could sell to speculative investors the warrant, which is basically a bet that the stock's going to go up. It's like an option. So the detachable warrants are more valuable than the non-detachable warrants. But the non-detachable warrants are still nice because when you sell the stock, it's carrying two little possible sweet pouches on its belt. That's enough for you. Talk to you on Thursday.